Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome to the show again. Today we have a third time on the show, Dr. Richard Beck. Welcome to the show, Richard.
It's good to be back. I think, is this a record of some sort?
Yeah, this is currently the record. First three-time guest on the show. That's pretty exciting for you, isn't it?
I'm trying to beat Jonathan Stormont. I got to stay out in front of him.
Yeah. Yeah, we posted the one with his new book a couple weeks ago, so I think he's on two or three.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're doing well. You're doing fine.
That's good to be back.
Yeah, last week you were down at the Christian Scholars Conference. Is that right?
Yes, in Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah. Now, for some reason, my invitation didn't come in the mail. I guess my email address got switched or something, but was it still a good time without me there?
It was. We missed you.
I'm sure you did.
Yeah. I always find it such a pretentiously entitled conference, the Christian Scholars Conference, but it's a Church of Christ thing, you know?
Is it?
And so, it's mainly, it grew out of the Churches of Christ academics gathering every summer, mainly in the Bible colleges of our sister schools. But it's since, in the last, you know, decade or so, become a lot more interdisciplinary. But I guess back in the day when they named it the Christian Scholars Conference, the Church of Christ theology was pretty sectarian, so we probably did think at one point that we were the only Christians doing scholarship at the time.
But, yes, and some probably still think that.
You would hope that they don't, but I'm sure some people somewhere think that.
Well, I'm sure it's not the people who are listening to this podcast, because we have heretics like Richard Beck on.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. You know, I was looking back at your blog, and I saw a post that you put up on the very day that we scheduled this podcast. And it made me feel really good, because on the day that we scheduled, hey, we're going to talk this day, you posted a poem entitled, I Thank You, God, for Most This Amazing Day. And so I felt like you posted that Cummings poem because you were really excited to come back on the show.
Whenever I think of you, Luke, I put poetry on my blog. Pretty much all readers can process that man crush that I have on you. And so,
well, yeah. I look forward to you comparing me to a summer's day, even though I am more lovely and more temperate. So we'll do that in the future. But we did not come here to talk about how much Richard Beck loves me. We came here to talk about an interesting phenomenon that seems to happen around these holidays. Mother's Day was not too long ago. Father's Day is coming up just in a few days. And actually, that's why we have Richard Beck on the show, because something happens on Father's Day that's completely different than what happens on Mother's Day. On Mother's Day, at churches across this fine nation of ours and across the world, probably. I don't really know about the world part, but definitely in the nation. We get up and we say, mothers, you are doing the work of God. We appreciate you. You are loved. You are special. Thank you for all the sacrifices you make. That's what we do on Mother's Day. But Father's Day comes around, and we say something completely different. We say, fathers, you need to step it up. And so I was curious, why do we have such different experiences with Father's Day and Mother's Day? Why do we communicate one thing to mothers and different things to fathers? And I thought, Richard, you could answer this question for me.
That's a big question, isn't it?
Yeah. So we've got probably a few things we need to talk about, but let's just jump in wherever you think we should start.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I think that there's something about the affections and the attachments that we have with mothers. I'm going to get all psychological here. That there's these emotional connections with mothers on both sides, right? Men and women have these connections with their mothers, and that there seems to be something lacking, perhaps in the intimacy and the affections with fathers, that might be the beginning point. We can come back to that in a little bit.
Okay.
But I also think that there's an ambivalence in the church about fathers and fatherhood, and in a general sense that men in our culture are not living up to God's calling in their life. And I think in some ways that is possibly is rooted in reality, but I also think some of that is also due to some kind of some issues that Christians are having with gender roles and fatherhood and motherhood in the church, and that there's this general sense that men need to exert themselves more in the world and in Christianity, and two locations for that would be the home and then also the church. So I guess it represents kind of an underlying anxiety that women are outperforming men in the familial and the spiritual realms.
Okay, so you look at a church, average church, typically is going to have more women than men, right?
Right.
I don't know if I didn't do the research on that, but I've been a preacher and I've seen that being my experience. And I know that's experience for a lot of other people. Do you think that is because women are stepping up more and they are having to carry the weight because the men are not as participatory in the life of the church?
You know, I think some of it has to do, and I don't know how far back we go. You'd have to get like a early church historian to answer whether or not women were the earliest and strongest responders to the gospel, and then a church historian about the degree to which women have responded to the spirituality and Christianity throughout time. But I agree with you. In our contemporary experiences, churches run on the labor and the leadership and the work of women. And I think we know that, and I think that's a part of that anxiety that comes out on the, you know, men need to step it up. I made a joke the other day in front of one of my classes that if women went on strike, Christianity would end overnight.
Yeah.
Most of the heavy lifting that occurs in the church, if you just think about the, what has to be executed from an operational perspective on a given Sunday morning, all of those Sunday school classes need to get taught. Somebody's got to sit in the nursery. Then if you think about all the kind of ministry and benevolence and all the food that gets coordinated in a class to take care of somebody who's having a baby or a shower. You know, my wife just went through a couple different wedding showers with some friends, and you know, that's almost wholly work done by women. But it's work that marks significant events, funerals, the birth of children, all those kinds of things. And so I think we've always seen that women are basically doing a lot of the kind of what we call the servant-oriented work. Mm-hmm. And so there's this kind of sense that, you know, well, what are the men doing? I think the problem is that the assumption is, and often a lot of those calls for the men to, quote, step up and do better is for somehow them to – the only roles that they see acceptable are not to step alongside the women into those same kind of roles. You know, you don't see men – when you hear a man step up – You're typically not asking him to bring a casserole to somebody during the week.
No.
And I think that's problematic in a certain way.
Why is that?
And so, well, I mean, because again, I mean, you're bifurcating the roles in the church and saying those kinds of things are things that women should do. What does that mean? If all the servant oriented roles are traditionally done by women, then essentially when you ask a man to step up, you're not asking him to be a servant. You're not asking him to step in those – you're not asking him to go into the nursery.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's not the stereotype. The stereotype isn't that you're asking him to go into the nursery. The stereotype isn't asking him to step up and go teach a Sunday school class. So the guy looks around and says, yeah, I do need to step up. So what are those roles that I'm supposed to do? And he's going to think of leadership roles in that sense. But the thing is, those roles might already be occupied. You might already have, you know, pastors already in place and staff members on place. So where's the guy to go? He's either going to have to displace somebody already in a leadership role, create his own ministry, or, you know, step into roles that have been traditionally aligned with what women are doing. So I think it puts them in a tough spot. So we make those calls, but unless we kind of really rethink what stepping up looks like, because if stepping up is supposed to look like Jesus, it might look like stepping
down.
Yeah. And that's the trick, I think, for a lot of men in churches.
So we have this idea that a man to step up is going to take a public leadership role, something that probably has a microphone, something that's in front of people. But you're saying that, you know, there aren't a million opportunities like that to serve. In churches, there are millions of opportunities to serve behind the scenes in smaller ways. But we typically don't see those as a role in which a man should fulfill. And so how do we reshape the conversation where we can communicate that for a man to step up, as it is for any person to step up, it means to serve and to look at some of these other roles?
Yeah, well, I wonder sometimes if the step up metaphor creates, you know, problems, because the metaphor itself implies moving upward. But we often, when we try to get men to participate more, we often somehow kind of challenge their manhood. You know what I mean? That's the whole metaphor of stepping up, is to somehow issue some sort of, like, you know, cry to battle, you know, and so we're evoking and we're activating a certain kind of aspect of gender psychology there, and saying for a man to, quote, be involved in the church, it is involved drawing a line in the sand, stepping across, and those kinds of things. And I wonder if there isn't something that needs to be reconfigured at a deeper level there. Because otherwise we're still just going to be kind of reinforcing the same things, that for a man to step up means to a man to exert himself, rather than, and I'm not saying that there isn't a time for any Christian to exert themselves, but when you're asking people to exert themselves in the body of Christ, I don't know if that creates the dynamic that Jesus is calling us to when he talks to his disciples and he says, listen, you know, the Gentiles, the leaders, they lord over each other. It should not be so among you. So I wonder if just the way we try to motivate men through the stepping up metaphor creates a really kind of toxic dynamic. It doesn't position a guy well. He's like, yeah, I do want to step. I do want to exert myself. And already I wonder if just with that opening chess move, he is awkwardly positioned for kingdom work.
Yeah. You mentioned it brings up gender psychology. Can you kind of speak into that a little bit? In what way does it speak into gender psychology?
Well, that's a fraught conversation. You know, I do think that, and this might be controversial, I've written a little bit about this week on my blog, is that I do think that statistically speaking, men are wired for kind of assertion and aggressiveness. I think, you know, one of the clearest gender differences worldwide is that, you know, most aggressive or violent crime is committed by males. I mean, I think there is something in the male psychology that is wired a certain way. And I think that is for dominance, let's say. Now, the trouble with saying that is that, you know, God created men for those roles, and therefore, because the genders are different in that regard, that reflects a created kind of intent. And my argument is that I think we could recognize gender distinctives, statistically speaking, recognizing that they vary across individuals, that for any given male or female, kind of an assertiveness, what psychologists would call it, agency. They used to be called masculinity and femininity. And then we realized that those were very stereotyping labels. So now we call it agency or communion. And people vary on those two personality types. So agency is that assertion, dominance, competitiveness. And then communion is the nurturing, affiliation, you know, connection. And we all vary on how those manifest. And so there can be a woman who has very agentic qualities, very dominant in the way she presents herself, can be very competitive. And there can be men that are very communally oriented, and they're not very dominant in that sense. All that to say is that I do think there's good cross-cultural evidence that suggests that men statistically tend to be higher on agency and women higher on communion. And so the issue, though, is how then those relative tendencies are framed within the kingdom of God. Because I think what happens is that we assume that, okay, men have this agentic drive, and so therefore they should be put in leadership positions. My point about that is I do think there are people, men and women, who like to be in charge. They are, you know, leaders. That's their tendency. They look around at a situation and they say, this is a mess. Like, somebody needs to get in charge of this thing. They like to get in there and fix things. And they want systems and organizations to run better. They're charismatic. They're communicators. They can get people motivated. They can kick people in the pants and get them going. I think men and women can do that equally. And I think when people, I think that's a gifting. The thing that I the problem with all of that comes is that there are certain temptations that occur with that, that kind of energy that the agentic person has creates temptations. The problem I have with quote unquote guys taking charge is that it's implicitly, this is the point I'm leading to, it's implicitly a taking charge over against women. It's excluding them from ever taking charge. It's taking charge over against them. I don't mind people taking charge. I mean, anybody who looks around a church thinks 99% of the time somebody needs to take charge of this, yep. You know, kind of thing. And I don't particularly care who it is that takes charge sometimes. I like, you know, I like leaders to step up. So my issue isn't people taking charge. It is the implicit theological assumption that if somebody's gifted to take charge, that they can't, you know, they can't take charge because of their gender.
Yeah.
So I do think that there is a way to recognize gender differences in those personality types. And there is a way to kind of recognize that some people, because of their personality, are more prone to taking charge, wanting to be in those leadership positions. To me, though, the move to say that certain people are excluded from that because of their gender is to me the additional step that I struggle with.
Yeah, that's very problematic. If you have people who have giftings that can't use them in the church, no one wants to see that happening. So let's go back to the agency issue. If you have a gentleman who is wired for agency, he is a leader, he is someone who wants to take charge, maybe in the workplace, he is in a position of leadership. He comes to church, he's told, hey, you need to step up. And he looks around and goes, there's no way for me to use this gift. Does he therefore just shrink back and say, well, I can't use my gift, so I'm going to sit in the back row and I'm not going to be participatory? I feel like that's probably what's going on with some of these gentlemen. If that's the only way of understanding serving is by actually leading, then they can't get involved. And so the only opportunities we have for them are more categorically communion type roles. And so they don't see that as an option for them, so they don't really want to do anything. Do you think that's what's going on?
Yeah, I do. I think there's a lot of people out there that recognize that there's kind of a crisis with masculinity and Christianity. And there are two ways I think people have been trying to go about fixing that problem. One would be the kind of feminist approach, which is to say the reason that's a problem is because there's a fundamental problem with masculinity in America. And so for that guy to get plugged in at church, he needs to rethink that kind of his masculinity, because he's constructed his identity in such a way that has created this problem. So the problem's with that guy and the way he feels like, hey, if I'm not a leader and I'm not in charge, then I'm checking out. He needs to rethink. And so for him, it would be a call to learn how to let go, kenosis, step down, go to the nursery, learn to serve, submit himself to the leadership of women in the nursery, or submit himself to a female pastor. You know what I mean? He needs to learn how to be mutually submissive and so on and so forth. So that's one way to go. Mm-hmm. The other way to go is to go the route of like the Piper and the Driscoll and the kind of the neo-reform crowd, and to say the problem isn't with that guy. These guys are the way they are. The problem is that Christianity has become too feminized. Mm-hmm. You know, that's their move. And so that's you know, that infamous Driscoll video, the chickified church and the he walks into church and it's all feminine. So what we need is a masculine Christianity. So the problem is with the problem is the way we've used worship songs and the whole vibe of Christianity has tended to kind of marginalize these quote unquote real guys. And so those seem to be the two on the left and the right ways of going about why that guy's checking out. Mm-hmm. One is because we need to create a more of an attractional Christianity for that guy, one that has more of a masculine feel. That's one route. And the other route is the feminist thing. This is no Christianity insofar as it's going to privileged servanthood, and insofar as servanthood has always been associated with those communal tendencies, then that guy's got to check his agency and learn how to rethink being a man isn't about lording over, but it is about serving. And that means he's got to reconfigure. The problem isn't Christianity. The problem is the way masculinity, he's been raised to be a man and define that. And so there is going to have to be some discipleship of his masculinity. And those seem to be the two.
Yeah, the two options
that are out things there. that seem to be going on out there.
Yeah, and so on the one hand, I love the line that says, you know, the biggest threat to the church is not strong women, but it's weak men. Okay, so it's not because you have a woman who's gifted that's not causing men to be lackluster in their involvement. It's the fact that they are being lackluster, and so I agree with that. But let me take the other side, just for the sake of argument here. What if, you know, part of the problem is you go to church and there are gentlemen who have more agency leanings, okay? They're more the stereotypical masculine role, and they don't see examples of other masculine men who do the things they do, who like the things they like, acting in a way that really is using a gift other than being on stage. I think that's a fair critique, that you need to have examples of men who are stepping up and leading, not by taking a microphone, but by serving. And so in one way, say you're a new guy, you come to church, and maybe you don't have a master's degree in philosophy, and so you're not really interested in these quotes, and you're not interested in being more emotive and sharing your feelings, and that doesn't really attract you at all. What you like to do is other type of stuff that are stereotypically male things. You do need to see guys who embody the same sort of lifestyle you do, who are living out the way of Jesus in front of you. But if you don't have that example, how can you really step in and do that? See what I'm saying?
No, I definitely see what you're saying. I think part of the problem is just the way we have constructed church. Because, I mean, if you think about what American churches are, they're fundamentally about putting on the Sunday morning event.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and that's kind of that's why we hire staff. You know, we hire a preacher, we hire a praise minister, you know, we have a building that is empty Monday through Saturday for the most part because we need a big venue to host the Sunday morning thing. So all that to say is you're right. If that's all we're doing is putting on the Sunday morning event and we're asking people to quote unquote be leaders of whatever gender, then that is a very narrow, you know, that's a very narrow window for anybody to plug in.
Yeah.
And that's why I think men and women are so fixated upon who preaches, you know, so it's, you know, for a woman to preach or a man to preach. So we're focused on that, but we're still focused on Sunday morning. And I think that's a battle worthy to be fought. But it is a pretty narrow vision because, so maybe we got to rethink of what church looks like. But to your point, I do think that men with stereotypical gender interests, they're going to need to find locations in the church where those can connect. And I think that's a lot of what the male minister, male ministries, you know, tried to do is they try to find locations and connections like that. The trouble I run into or experience with when that happens is that the whole notion of the male ministry in many sectors, you know, progressive sectors, is suspect because the worry is it's going to just foster more that kind of chest thumping kind of activity. And so there needs to be a lot of grace in these conversations. You have I wrote a post about Mark Dristico a long time ago, and one of the things I noted in the post was that the divide between there's a war between the genders, and the way men judge other men and the way women judge other women, and a lot of it fractures on educational divide.
Yeah.
One of the things that we know in psychology is that as the genders get more educated, as women get more education and men get more education, they look more and more like psychologically. Men start very educated men. Look more feminine in their dispositions and interests. They're less stereotypical. So an educated man might be, you know, more interested in, like you and I were bantering about poetry earlier on, you know. So that's interested in poetry, the culinary arts, theater, those things. And women, as they get more educated, become much more career-minded and interested in their own success and leadership roles. But so what happens in my church, at least, is that you have a kind of, because it's a university church, got a lot of professors at my church. So you got these progressive guys like myself, and then you hear about a men's ministry starting up, and it's not going to, a Wild at Heart ministry, or back in the day, I don't know if Promise Keepers is still around, but Promise Keepers and things like that. You know, a lot of the judgment of those ministries are going to come from the progressive, educated men who see that as a retreat into kind of primitive masculinity that should have been, you know, a good old liberal arts education should have educated that out of you. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't need that anymore. It's doubling down on some bad stereotypes and insights about what a man is. And that's, to me, one of the biggest battles that has to be fought in churches, is that educational divide. Because I do think that if we are privileging the Sunday morning experience, and you are a guy that doesn't have a master's degree, you know, your opportunity to teach or preach or get up there is going to be limited. Mm-hmm. So where else do you know, where else do you go in that sense? So there's an educational aspect to it all that I have struggled with in my own church, in trying to figure out a way to communicate grace across that divide and let people find out what's life-giving to them. To me, the thing I keep coming back to is, like, listen, I don't mind, and I preached a sermon with Jonathan about this back in the fall. To me, I was very specific when I said stereotypical gender role. Like, if you like NASCAR, stereotypically, that's a male thing. Mm-hmm. It's not uniquely so. There are women who love NASCAR.
My grandma likes NASCAR.
And there's the Danica Patricks that are NASCAR drivers. I mean, the point being is it's a stereotypical gender role. Right. But what about the hunting and the fishing and the NASCAR, the fixing cars, you know? What about any of that involves domineering or power over any other person? And that's the thing that I keep coming back to, is if your definition or construct of masculinity is inherently tied up with notions of power, being the boss of somebody else, being in charge of somebody else, then you're going to have I agree very much with the feminist critique of masculinity. If that's what masculinity means, then it's going to have to get deconstructed. But I think, even when we're talking before about leadership, the leadership you and I were talking about, the agentic person of whatever gender, that leadership is inherently a service. You know, most people who are leading in a church, like I'm a chair of a psychology department, and most of my leadership is servant stuff. It is coordinating. It is, you know, while everybody's off having fun, you're back, you know, working on a spreadsheet or trying to make plans. I mean, anybody who's ever been a real leader knows that it is an act of service. It's not, at least in churches, yeah, you're trying to do a lot of coordinating. Like, think about what the children's minister has to do at a church. I mean, that's brutal work to coordinate all those Sunday school volunteers every week. You know, I mean, I don't know how they do it. Suzette at our church, I mean, that woman's a hero in my book. I mean, that is hard, brutal work. And so she's the leader. Mm-hmm. But more than anything, she's running around freaking out trying to get Sunday school put on every week, week after week after week. So even when somebody, quote unquote, takes charge in the church, it's not like this top-down CEO kind of thing that starts to dictate. It can. That's the toxic thing. But mostly it's this it's a servant, you know, kind of leadership.
Yeah.
All that to say is, I think people can be however they want to be. They can express themselves however they want to express. It's the main discernment issue when we're discerning the spirits here is whether or not you think you have to be in charge of somebody else, if you can boss somebody around. Mm-hmm. And that's, to me, when gender roles get toxic in the church, is when power gets usurped by one group over against another group. And I don't necessarily care about the genders of those particular groups. I care about whether or not somebody's lording over another group.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good
feeling. Feeling as your job to say no to somebody. That's my worry. Like when there's a group of people in the church saying no to somebody else, that's a worry.
Yeah. That's, yeah, that's a good word. Hey, let's circle back to what you said at the very beginning. You wanted, you briefly touched on the emotional connections that exist, and that's definitely something that's going on here. And as we're talking about this, it kind of reminded me of the stereotypical gender treatment when there is a boo-boo with a little kid. You know, little girl falls down, scrapes her knee. I say to my daughters, oh, come here, let me give you a hug. Oh, baby, you're okay. Daddy loves you. Something like that. A boy falls down, scrapes his knee. We say, you're okay, you're tough, you're fine, you're okay, you're tough. Do you think some of the different ways that we treat, you know, little boys, little girls is carried over into how we treat moms and dads?
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that, but that are you basically suggesting that that we get kind of we socialize the genders in such a way that men aren't supposed to receive just lots of warm fuzzies, and that they can be given kind of their due recognition without a lot of additional hugs and kisses and things like that. I wonder about that attention, because the idea would be that, I think the negative side of that would be that you're suggesting that moms, because they're women, need a more of an emotional connection, because they're women, and that dads don't need that as much. So you can kind of be fairly perfunctory with dad. Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing.
I can see that.
Yeah. So our, at our church, we've got a group of four ladies who lead the children's ministry. There are men who teach and involve, but it's four women who lead that. And we put a lot of emphasis on Mother's Day, a lot of emphasis when it comes to Father's Day. And this is a group of four women who are leading that. When it comes to Father's Day, one of them is like, yeah, I don't know what we're going to do. My son said, we'll just give every dad a beer. And I thought, okay, that probably would work well with our church. But
there you go.
But so there is – that group expresses the same sort of sentiments that I know from a lot of my fellow pastors feel, is that there's pressure on Mother's Day to say the right thing and do the right thing. But on Father's Day – you just throw something out there and it's not a big deal. Feelings are not going to get hurt. And so I don't know where that pressure is coming from. I'm assuming the pressure is coming from the fact that someone has gotten chewed out in the past because they didn't do enough on Mother's Day, and so they don't want to repeat that. But there definitely seems to be more of a pressure to make Mother's Day more special than Father's Day. And I don't know if part of it is the fact that most of the pastors that I'm talking of are men. And so you have men speaking to women on Mother's Day, which is one dynamic, and then men speaking to men, which is another dynamic. I don't feel like I have to be as coddly and encouraging to men, but I want to be respectful and appreciative of women. And maybe that's just an inherent sexism that I haven't really unearthed in myself, but I don't know what's going on there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be lots of different things. I mean, one could be the kind of benevolent sexism. You ever heard of that phrase, benevolent sexism? You know, but it's less playing out with putting we usually discuss benevolent sexism, the role of kind of a romantic relationship. So you put the woman on the pedestal. She's the damsel. She's the princess. We care for her. We take care of her because, she's captivating. And so it's still sexist because it's still putting her in a sense of like, she's an object that needs to be cared for. Mm. We think about that in husbands and wives, in romantic. So the chivalry idea is this benevolent sexism idea. But I can see how, given what you just said, that could play out with mothers. Mothers are put on that. I think the difference with mothers, though, is that when we're talking about romance, it is still fundamentally an issue of kind of attraction. But with mothers, I think it's not just benevolent sexism. I do think there's a sense that we recognize that mothers put in an enormous amount of work that often goes unrecognized. Yeah. And that there is a burden of, I think there's a sense of just awe in registering what stereotypically, again, not, you know, but if you talk about, you know, stereotypical mothers, the amount of care that they have put into all of us that maybe we don't see as much, you know, on the father's side. And so therefore there is that sense that there is an asymmetry in what we owe mom versus a dad. And so we're trying to meet that. To somehow mess up Mother's Day would be considered offensive, because it would just, you know, not register the sense of gratitude that we feel, you know. And that sets up a different thing about, you know, what is it about fathers that we don't feel quite that debt of obligation that we do, you know, yeah, with mothers. And that's kind of where I said at the very beginning, I do think there's something about that primary attachment with mothers that I don't know if it's replicable on the father side. It can be with if you have a bad mother, or mm-hmm, you don't have a mother and you lose your mother, that the father can be that. But again, stereotypically, there is something in the affective attachment bonding. And this attachment theorist have been talking about this for, you know, quite some time, that there is something special about mothers. And maybe that comes out on Mother's Day.
Yeah. Do you remember the old Bill Cosby bit where he talks about, you know, dad teaches his son to throw a football, dad teaches his son how to catch a football, and dad teaches his son how to be a football player. He grows up, plays in the NFL, wins the Super Bowl, and afterwards he says, when he gets on the camera and he's interviewed, and he says, I want to thank mom. Thank you, mom. That's what he says. And he's right. There's something that's going on that makes moms receive that extra adulation that fathers don't get. And I feel like I'm very sexist right now by saying that. You made me fear that I'm a benevolent sexist. So I'm sorry. I didn't mean that. But there's definitely—
No, I don't think so. By putting moms at the center of our universes, I think it's different from benevolent sexism. It's not putting moms up on a pedestal because we think they're dependent. We're putting up on a pedestal because we realize they sit at the effective center of human society. Yeah. Just because they are the ones that you know, give birth. I mean, we are mammals, which means we are named after the breasts of women.
Never thought about it that way, but yes, I see that.
But what I'm saying is, our biological species, you know, mammals, were named after women, you know, what they do to give birth. And one of the things that distinguishes mammals from reptiles is the child rearing aspect of what mammals do, the connection between the mama bear and the baby cub. That is, you know, we don't eat our young, you know what I'm saying? Like a reptile would. There is an effective emotional bond that mammals have and that we are a part of. And it begins and is rooted with, you know, with mothers. And I think there's a biological root to this. It's not just gender construction. I think that asymmetry and effective connection is rooted deep, deep in our biology.
Yeah. Well,
it'd be hard for a dad to replace that. I mean, a lot of guys feel marginalized when their wives are breastfeeding. You know, I know that might be kind of weird, but there's a lot of guys that you want to effectively connect with their child. But if your wife is breastfeeding, you are out of the loop on that for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? I mean, when that child cries, the one that responds is the mother. And we know from infant psychology that babies recognize the face of their mother before all their faces. Mm-hmm. They look toward her face more quickly. They recognize her scent, the sound of her voice. They're listening to the sound of her voice in the womb, and they recognize it upon being born. I mean, that child is so— psychologists call it attunement. The emotional and social attunement of the child and the mother are synchronized, you know, in the womb and afterwards. And I don't know. There is just not a way to replicate that on the male side.
Yep.
And I think maybe that's one of the, you know, if you're going to get into feminist scholarship here, you can argue that one of the reasons why there is patriarchy in the world is because men recognize that. they recognize that power and are afraid of it, and therefore exert power over women because they recognize that at deep down at the biological, we're deep down at the level of biology, we're a matriarchal society.
Wow.
And so there's a fear there. That, I mean, that would be the argument for the root of patriarchy, an unease at the power of women, that if it was ever unleashed, you know, would overthrow and marginalize men. Now, you can agree or disagree with that. I'm just saying there is, even in patriarchy, a sense that there is a power sitting, residing there with mothers that is hard to capture on the male side.
Wow, that's fascinating. Well, Richard, thanks for your time. It's good stuff. Appreciate it, man.
Appreciate it, buddy.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.